This is a podcast from RTE Radio 1.
Hello, I'm Alan Stanford, and welcome to Macbeth in Monaghan.
When shall we three meet again? In thunder, lightning, or in rain?
Go, get him, Sir Dilemma!
God save the king!
The victory fell on us!
Hooray!
What he had lost, noble Macbeth had won!
Look! What I have, show me, show me!
Hark!
Speak!
Macbeth!
Macbeth!
Hark!
That shall be king hereafter!
Stay! You imperfect speakers, tell me more!
Beware the thing of the fight!
What? Can the devil speak true?
Oh. Look to the lady!
Come, you spirits!
Duncan comes here tonight.
Thanks.
Bring forth men, Shirley. This is a sorry sight.
Macbeth does murder sleep. Macbeth shall sleep no more.
A little water clears us of this need.
Wake, Duncan, with thy knocking! I want the corpse!
Horror! Horror!
To make them kings, the seed of Banquo kings! Which of you have done this?
Murder and treason!
Hello and welcome again to St. Louis Secondary School, Carrick na Cross in County Monaghan for the fourth and final programme of our series Macbeth in Monaghan. Pupils from Monaghan Collegiate School, Patrician High School and St. McCartan's College will join us again for this, our final programme. This last programme deals to a large extent with the final act of the play, with Act 5, which is the revenge. We've already seen through the previous programmes the gradual descent into chaos. We had the prophecy, we had the murder, we had the betrayal, and we've had the genocide. And it's almost like a great wheel moving down a hill. Scotland descends slowly into chaos because of one man's ambition. But we mustn't forget at any point that it's a man, not a monster. It's not some wild animal. It's a human being with human frailty, a man who could have been a hero, was a national hero, but who became corrupted because of his own ambition and because of the temptations that fate put in his way. The witches, the weird sisters, are like, in Greek tragedy, the fates. They are the option you could take. They have said, this will happen. This is the future. And the temptation of that future destroys Macbeth, and with him, the country that he is meant to govern. He has brought it to its knees. He has really destroyed it by his own actions, by his own vanity, by his own desires, by his own ambition. However, the night is long that never finds the day, says Malcolm, and Malcolm is coming. High up on his castle in Dunsinane, Macbeth the tyrant waits, but Malcolm and his army are approaching.
The English power is near, led on by Malcolm, his uncle Seward, and the good Macduff.
Revenge is born in them, for their dear causes would to the bleeding and grim alarm excite the mortified man.
Neil Ben and Mord shall we well meet them. That way are they coming.
What does the tyrant?
Great Dunsinane he strongly fortifies.
Some say he's mad.
Others that lesser hate him, they call it valiant fury.
But for certain, he cannot buckle his distempered cause within the belt of rule.
Now does he feel his secret mortar sticking on his hands.
Those he commands move only in command, nothing in love.
Now does he feel his title hang loose about him, like a giant's robe upon a dwarfish teeth.
Who then shall blame his passive senses to recoil and starve, when all that is within him does condemn itself for being there?
Well, march we on to give obedience where it is truly owed.
Meet we the medicine of the sickly wheel.
And with him pour we in our country's purge each drop of us.
Make we our march towards Birnam.
So waiting in the wings, or at least in the forest, is the avenging hero. And thank you to Jonathan Williams, Sean Carolan, Patrick Moyner, Dara Hamill and Daryl Caplice for reading in those parts.
My name is Sarah Cleary and I'm a sixth year student in Castor College, County Limerick. In the continuing literary quarrel of good versus evil, we are presented with two characters, Macbeth and Macduff. Macduff seems to mature in nobility and virtue, becoming a stronger and more admirable character, despite the circumstance of tragedy dealt to him. He grows to become a hero, unlike his arch-rival Macbeth, who rivets himself on the tragedies he causes, and thus becomes a tyrant. Macduff becomes essential to Shakespeare's Macbeth, as he portrays the overcoming force of good, just as Macbeth represents a person succumbing to the force of evil. Macduff and Macbeth are a study of opposites. When it was Macbeth's duty to protect Duncan, he murdered him. When Lady Macbeth advised, "Sleek o'er your rugged locks, be bright and jovial among your guests," Macbeth proved himself to be an adept actor when he deceived Banquo, his friend. Macduff, on the other hand, had used his own ambitions to bring justice to his country and kinsmen, not to attain personal triumph. When Macbeth assassinated Duncan, he was not numbed so much by grief as by repentance. This becomes clearly evident when he exclaims, "Wake Duncan with thy knocking, I would thou couldst." His primary reaction to the murder was guilt. When Macduff learned of the murder of his family, his immediate reaction was one of profound grief. Malcolm advised him to dispute it like a man, to which Macduff sincerely replied, "I shall do so, but I must also feel it as a man." Macduff did not dwell on his guilt. His ability to convert his anguish into useful energy, aided by the wise counsel of comforting friends, allow him to avoid the dangerous snare of haunting consciences and felling sorrow, which culminates in the downfall of Macbeth. At one point, the two characters were similar. In the first act, Macbeth was described by the sergeant as brave and like Valier's minion, proving him to be the equal of Macduff. However, Macbeth had one fatal flaw, ambition. Macduff and Macbeth are truly an intricate study of differences and similarities. At first it seemed as if Macduff developed in virtue and nobility, growing beyond his tragedies, but now in retrospect we see that it was he who remained constant, and Macbeth who slipped from these traits, drowning in the guilt of his self-inflicted tragedies. From Macduff we are shown why good succeeds, for good possesses the qualities of nobility, sincerity and righteousness, the ability to convert anguish to useful energy. Good, which retains all these traits, shall prevail.
My name is Seamus Connolly from St. McCartan's College, Monaghan. My favourite quotation is, "Out, out, brief candle, life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more." At the beginning of the play, Macbeth is presented to us as an all-conquering general, a very ambitious man who will do anything to succeed in life. This quotation is a reflection by Macbeth on life as he sees it. He has achieved all his ambitions but is still unhappy. He is a very different man to that at the start of the play. He no longer can see any meaning to life. He also makes reference to the fragile nature of life. Like a walking shadow, it can be ended by the extinguishing of a candle.
My name is Aaron Ridgway. I'm a student at St. Vincent's High School. My favourite quote from the play Macbeth is probably the "Is this a dagger I see before me" soliloquy. And the reason I like this quote is because it clearly shows us the amount of mental stress that Macbeth is under at this point. The handle of the dagger, the handle of opportunity, is facing him as the blade leads him and points toward Duncan's chamber. The phrase, "I have thee not, and yet I see thee still," it's something that everyone can relate to, having something within their grasp, but without the length with which to reach it. The fact that we can relate to him so easily in many instances of the play only serves as a poignant and tragic comparison. The gouts of blood which appear on the blade are the price he must pay to obtain his catalyst to the kingship. No matter how much mental turmoil he may be in, he goes through with his regicide, and thus succumbing to the evil seed blossoming inside him.
So Shakespeare now sets up a situation where you have Macbeth in his castle, Malcolm outside. In other words, a siege situation. Malcolm is going to attack the castle at Dunsinane, the one place in the world that Macbeth feels safe. Why? Because the witches told him he is perfectly safe and he cannot be overcome till Burnham Forest come to Dunsinane. So that's where he knows he's safe. He feels secure and he is very, very confident.
"Bring me no more reports. Let them fly all. Till Burnham Wood remove to Dunsinane, I cannot taint with fear. What's the boy, Malcolm? Was he not born of woman? The spirits that know all mortal consequences have pronounced me thus. Fear not, Macbeth. No man that's born of woman shall ever have power upon thee. Then fly, false Danes, and mingle with the English epicures. The mind I sway by and the heart I bear shall never sag with doubt nor shake with fear."
He sounds incredibly confident, but the growing news of Malcolm's arrival does seem to worry him a little. Macbeth himself has reached a strange kind of plateau where he seems to have lost all fear, but he's also becoming very conscious of the reality of what he himself is. It's as though a kind of despair and a loneliness is creeping into him, a realization that he's not the man that he once dreamed he would be. News comes of the approaching army.
The devil damn thee back, thou cream-faced loon. Where scots thou that goose luck?
There is 10,000.
Geese, villain?
Soldier, so.
Death of thy soul, those linen cheeks of thine are counsellors to fear. What soldiers, wayface?
The English force, so please you.
Take thy face hence. Seaton, I am sick at heart, while I behold. Seaton, I say, this push will cheer me ever, or deceit me now.
This push will cheer me ever, or deceit me now. This is it. This is the be-all and the end-all. This is the moment that will decide his future.
I have lived long enough. My way of life is fallen into the sear, the yellow leaf.
In other words, he's admitting that he's actually beginning to come towards a possible end.
And that which should accompany old age, as honour, love, obedience, troops of friends, I must not look to have, but in their stead, curses, not loud but deep, mouth honour, breath, which the poor heart would fain deny and dare not. Seaton!
And what he's saying here is that he has realised that all around him are nothing but sycophants, people who will praise him because they're afraid of him. No true friends left. He will not look forward to a happy retirement. There is no happy retirement for someone like Macbeth. All he has is people cursing him behind his back. Not loud curses, but very deep. People paying mouth honour, saying, yes, your majesty, no, your majesty, but not really meaning it. And too afraid to admit it. Then more news comes.
What news more?
All is confirmed, my lord, which was reported.
I'll fight till from my bones my flesh be hacked. Give me mine armour.
'Tis not needed yet.
I'll put it on. Send out more horses. Scare the country round. Hang those that talk of fear. Give me mine armour.
It's strange that at this moment he probably shows more courage than at any other time in the play since the very beginning when he killed MacDonald. Here he is under siege, an army of 10,000 soldiers outside his castle. But he shows no fear. I'll put my armour on, I'm going to fight. Yes, he's confident that he himself cannot be killed. Yes, he's confident that he cannot be overcome. But it's still a daunting prospect, and it does show an incredible amount of courage. And thank you to David O'Hagan as Macbeth, Kieran Smith as the servant, and Ronan Lennon as Seaton in that sequence.
I'm Mark Patrick Hederman from Glenstall Abbey, and I'm talking to you about free will in the tragedy of Macbeth. The whole play of Macbeth concerns whether or not Macbeth was free to do what he did and to become what he became, King of Scotland, and later on then to have committed the murders that he did commit, and whether or not this was his own doing or whether he was forced to do it by powers outside his control represented by the witches. The witches made promises to him such as that he would not be killed by any person except somebody who wasn't actually of woman born, and that nothing would happen to him, he would never be conquered till Birnam would remove to Dunsinane. Now, he believed that those things couldn't possibly happen, and therefore he was perfectly free to carry on his particular career, and that he would be protected by these powers. Now, in the end of the play, obviously, he is shown that this was a trick. The enemy used the unusual ploy of cutting down great branches from Birnam Wood to camouflage themselves so that the lookout in his castle think that Birnam Wood is moving to Dunsinane. And also he discovers that Macduff was from his mother's womb untimely ripped, so that therefore he has been tricked doubly by the witches. Now, he himself at that moment, Macbeth, reveals himself to be a very brave and almost pitiable person, because instead of cringing and falling into despair, he says, no, let's go to the end. Lay on Macduff, and damned be him that first cries, hold enough.
More bad news is coming concerning the health of his wife.
How does your patient, doctor?
Not so sick, my lord, as she is troubled with tick-coming fancies that keep her from her rest.
Cure her of that. Canst thou not minister to a mind diseased? Pluck from the memory of a rooted sorrow, raise out the written troubles of the brain, and with some sweet oblivious antidote, cleanse the stuffed bosom of the perilous stuff, which weighs upon the heart.
Therein the patient must minister to himself.
Throw physic to the dogs, I'll none of it. Come, put mine armour on, give me my staff. Seaton, send out. Doctor, the thanes fly from me.
Doctor, the thanes fly from me. It's the only little indication we get, but what he's saying is, even the people who are supporting him in the castle are beginning to run away. He's beginning to be left alone.
Come, sir, dispatch. If thou couldest, doctor, cast the water of my land, find her disease, and purge it to a sound and pristine health. I would applaud thee to the very echo that should applaud again.
What he's doing here, in a strange way, is comparing Scotland and his wife. He's saying, you can't cure my wife. He's saying, I can't cure Scotland. I wish you could. I wish you could make it all better. It's that cry from the heart that says, I've made a terrible mess of everything. I wish somebody could put it right, but nobody can.
Pull it off, I say. What rhubarb, thyme, or what purgative drug would scare these English hence? Bring it after me. I will not be afraid of death and bane till Birmingham Forest comes to Dunstan.
Still that belief that he is perfectly safe till Birmingham Forest come to Dunsinane. And thank you to Michael Hanratty as the doctor and David O'Hagan from Macbeth, both from Patrician. Thank you.
My name is Anna Lynch. I'm a teacher in Inver College, and I'm going to outline how to structure an answer on Lady Macbeth. It's important that all students would begin by underlining the keywords in the question that they have been given. Next, they must begin to plan their question, beginning with a thesis statement which restates the task that has been assigned to them. Brainstorm the thesis, dividing it into numbers of related issues. Each of these issues will in turn become a paragraph in their essay. Link the text and or performance to each issue in each paragraph. Make a firm decision in the concluding paragraph with regard to the opening thesis. Avoid sitting on the fence at this point, as the examiner will be looking for a definite answer. Restate the opening thesis afresh. An example answer is, in her final scenes, Lady Macbeth is isolated in her suffering and demented state. How did she change from my dearest partner of greatness to a queen whose death is not mourned? She should have died hereafter. Lady Macbeth first appears in Act 1, Scene 5. She reads a letter that has been sent to her by her husband, informing her of the weird sisters and their prophecies. Instantly, Lady Macbeth decides which course of action she must take. She asks the spirits to unsex me here, fill her with the cruelty necessary to carry out her plan. Macbeth enters and addresses his wife as my dearest love. This is our first indication of the bond that exists between these two. They are both singing from the same hymn sheet with regard to Duncan's murder and their accession to the throne of Scotland. As Macbeth begins to waver in Act 1, Scene 7, students should note how steadfast Lady Macbeth is in her role. Having just witnessed the intimacy and confidence in this relationship, we now see that he expects guidance and inspiration from her also. She is his strength. She knows her husband well. As Macbeth cowers and says, "We will proceed no further in this business," Lady Macbeth remains focused. She accuses her husband of being unmanly, saying she would have killed her own baby if she had sworn to do so, rather than go back on her word. While this statement from Lady Macbeth may give rise to universal hatred due to its travesty of the Madonna ideal, it is important to remember at this point that she knows what is required to inspire her dithering husband, and she will go to any lengths to deliver it. Lady Macbeth's sense of determination is to the fore at this point. As we watch the murder plan unfold, we soon realise that Lady Macbeth is not the most intelligent of women. She may be determined, cold and calculated, but her plan for Duncan's murder is a simple one. As she prepares the murder scene, we glimpse the sentimental side of Lady Macbeth. She is unable to kill Duncan as he looks too like her father. Perhaps this is the side of his wife that Macbeth has never seen. Act 2, Scene 2 informs us that Lady Macbeth has drunk some of the alcohol with which she plied the guards, thus disclosing her nervous disposition at this point. We also witness that she regains her composure when Macbeth returns and his blunder is noted. She has the ability to mask her true thoughts and feelings in an instant, perhaps an indication of her Machiavellian nature. Unfortunately, as she advises her husband post-murder, consider it not so deeply, we also realise that she did not think beyond the action to the consequences of their crime. It is highly ironic that she says, "These deeds must not be thought after these ways, so it will make us mad." At this point, she is determined that sentiment and fear will not take hold of her. It is quite possible that at this point she is suppressing her true nature so that her husband may achieve his ambition to be king. Such suppression can only be short-lived. Although she corrects matters at the murder scene and callously says that a little water clears us of this deed, we know that her blood-stained hands will haunt her and drive her to her death. Also, she wanted the murder of Duncan to be carried out under the cover of darkness, giving witness to the fact that she is not without conscience, she merely suppresses it. Following on from this, students should deal with the banquet scene in detail and Lady Macbeth's fainting. A student might want to consider whether this is a real or artificial faint. After this incident, never again do we witness the steely resolve of previous scenes. Rather, we observe her gradual isolation, breakdown and suicide. Despite wallowing in her own guilt at this stage, she never shares it with her husband, nor does she show any weakness in his presence. She still supports Macbeth, who is oblivious to her deterioration. His role never seems to be to support her. She is no longer his trusted confidant. Undoubtedly, it is guilt and remorse that ultimately destroy Lady Macbeth. She is absent from Act 4, thus indicating her discarded status. Her function is complete. Her husband has abandoned her for a world of darkness, witches, and a campaign of terror.
Theatrically, Shakespeare keeps jumping from the castle out to the battlefield, or rather, to the woods, to keep that relentless pressure, the pressure of Malcolm's approach. No matter what's happening to Macbeth inside the castle, no matter what he's thinking, outside, Malcolm is approaching. That big army is getting closer and closer and closer. And out in the forest, Malcolm has a very clever idea.
What wood is this before us?
The wood of Birnam.
Let every soldier hew him down a bough and bear it before him. Thereby shall we shadow the numbers of our host and make discovery, ere in report of us.
We learn no other but the confident tyrant keeps still in Dunsinane and will endure our setting down before it.
This is me in hope.
The time approaches that will with due decision make us know what we shall say we have and what we owe.
Malcolm has decided to move Birnam Wood to Dunsinane. Thank you there to Daryl, to Dara, to Sean and to Patrick, all from Patrician for reading that. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Niamh McGuinness. I'm a student in St Sabine in Sutton. The quote I've chosen is from Act 2, Scene 2, spoken by Macbeth. "Methought I heard a voice cry, sleep no more, Macbeth does murder sleep. The innocent sleep, sleep that knits up the raveled sleeve of care, the death of each day's life, sore labour's bath, balm of hurt minds, great nature's second course, chief nourisher in life's feast." I chose this quote because it shows us how the murder is starting to get to Macbeth. He begins to hear his inner voice telling him that, having murdered the sleeping king, who is a prime example of innocent and natural sleep, he and his house will never again enjoy the benefits of another night's sleep. Himself and Lady Macbeth seem to believe that when they had the murder done, that everything would be fine and Macbeth would become king, but they never stopped to really think about the consequences.
Hi, I'm Jenny Gleese, and I'm from Laurhill Secondary School in Limerick. My favourite quote lies in Act 4, Scene 1, when the witches make their last appearance in the play, and they foretell the most important of the prophecies by means of apparitions. In these apparitions, Macbeth is told, "Beware Macduff, beware the Thane of Fife, for none of women born shall harm Macbeth, and Macbeth shall never vanquished be, until a great burning wood to hide Dunsinane Hill shall come against him." Reassured by the last two prophecies, Macbeth believes all he has to do is kill Macduff to retain his power. However, due to the absence of Macduff, he does not succeed, but instead carries out a frenzied attack on his castle, murdering his wife and child. It is at the very end of the play that we see the true meaning of the prophecies. I think Shakespeare was very effective in his approach to this. Macbeth thought it was impossible for Great Burning Wood to be at Dunsinane Hill. However, the English army used branches from Great Burning Wood as a form of camouflage when travelling to Dunsinane. Macbeth was warned to beware of Macduff. Macduff was the one who was to defeat him because technically he was not born properly via natural birth. He was from his mother's womb untimely ripped. When Macduff revealed the manner of his birth, Macbeth knew he was defeated. I thought that was very cleverly done, as I saw no relevance in the prophecies until the end. I was almost shocked when I realised how much actual sense they made.
My name is Tomás McEntee from St. McCarran's College, and my favourite quote is from the banquet scene, when Macbeth remarks, "I am in blood, stepped in so far that should I wait no more, returning were as tedious as go over." I like this quote because it illustrates the change that has occurred in Macbeth's character. In this scene, Macbeth realises it is easier to continue with killing than to return to the days when he was a brave and valiant general. He reflects on his descent from being the noble Macbeth of the first act to being a cruel and bloody tyrant. In this pivotal quote, we see who Macbeth has become and just how far he has deviated down the evil path.
Back up in the castle, Macbeth is demonstrating yet again his courage.
Hang out our banners on the outward walls. The cry is still, they come. Our castle's strength will laugh a siege to scorn. Here, let them lie, till famine and the ague eat them up. Were they not forced with those that should be ours, we might have met them dareful, beard to beard, and beat them backward home.
The reason he's sitting in that castle is not because he's afraid, but because he simply hasn't enough soldiers left to go out and fight a battle. He wants to do it. He wants to fight them. He wants to beat Malcolm out of the country. But he can't, because everyone is deserting him. And then, finally, the worst news for him.
The Queen, my lord, is dead.
She should have died hereafter. There would have been a time for such a word. Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps in this petty pace from day to day, to the last syllable of recorded time, and all our yesterdays have lighted fools, the way to dusty death. Out, out, brief candle. Life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage, and then is heard no more. It is a tale, told by an idiot, full of sand and fury, signifying nothing.
It's almost as though at this point Macbeth has begun to realise the absolute futility of his situation, the waste of his life. Life itself has been reduced in his mind to a poor player strutting and fretting his time upon the stage, a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury and meaning nothing. The whole of his life has been full of sound and fury. He's been a warrior, a king, a tyrant, and a genocidal megalomaniac. And all of that, at the end of the day, is brought down to nothing. His wife is dead. He is under siege. Everything has become almost meaningless. The only thing he's got left to do now is to fight. And now, at his lowest point, at the point when he is probably more depressed than at any other time in the play, there really does come news to cause fear in his soul and in his imagination. The prophecy returns to haunt him.
Gracious my lord, I should report that which I say I saw, but know not how to do it.
Well, say so.
As I did stand my watch upon the hill, I looked toward Burnham, and anon, methought, the wood began to move.
Liar and slave, if thou speakest false, upon the next tree thou shalt hang alive, till famine cling thee. If thy speech be sooth, I care not if thou dost for me as much. I pull in resolution, and begin to doubt the equivocation of the fiend that lies like truth. Fear not, till Burnham Wood do come to Dunsinane. And now a wood comes toward Dunsinane. Arm, arm, and out. If this which he avouches does appear, there is nor flying hence nor tarrying here. I begin to be wary of the sun, and wish the estate o'er the world were now undone. Ring the alarm and bell. Blow wind, come rack, at least we'll die with harness on our back.
And within this speech, everything seems to come together, finally. Burnham Wood is coming to Dunsinane. The prophecy is being fulfilled. It told him not to fear until Burnham Wood comes to Dunsinane. He made the assumption that it never would, but the prophecy told the truth. Now he fears the equivocation of the fiend. The fiend tells lies by telling the truth, deceives you with the truth. And Burnham Forest comes to Dunsinane. But he doesn't turn into a coward at this moment. He doesn't run away. His reaction is quite immediate and is the reaction of the hero that he once was. Arm, arm, and out. He had decided to fight the battle by staying within the castle and letting them besiege him. Now he knows, even though Burnham Wood is coming to Dunsinane, he will have to go out into the field and fight them in a conventional battle. He has to go out alone, if necessary, to fight them. I begin to be aweary of the sun. If we remember in the earlier stages of the play, he was constantly calling on the darkness, calling darkness down. Stars, hide your fires. Come, sealing night. All the time he wanted darkness, but he's been exposed to the sun. And Shakespeare here is using a double image as well, because it's not just the sun, S-U-N, but the sun, S-O-N, the son of Duncan. That's the blazing light that's coming to burn him. He's getting tired of it. He wants an end to it. But he wants to die the way he should, as a warrior, as a hero, with harness on his back. Thank you there to Michal and to David and to Ronan, from Patrician, for reading that scene.
My name is Daniel Waters. I'm from Inver College, and I'm going to speak about the use of poetic and aesthetic language in Macbeth. Language in Macbeth tends away from realism to pure poetic symbolism. The function of poetry is to highlight characters and actions and to create certain atmospheres. Shakespeare was faced with the task of making a tragic hero out of a murderer. By giving Macbeth a sensitive conscience, he endowed him with nobility. By giving him the speech of a poet, he endowed him with grandeur. Macbeth's mind is like that of a poet, imaginative, sensitive to impressions, and productive of violent disturbances of mind and body. For me, one of the most heartfelt and poetic speeches comes when he is informed of the death of his dearest partner and greatness. As we read the lines of his soliloquy in Act 5, Scene 5, we can almost feel his contempt for life, which he regards as meaningless. Life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage, and then is heard no more. It is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing.
My name's Sarah Hall, and I'm from Monaghan Collegiate School. My favourite quote from Macbeth is, "Why should I play the Roman fool and die upon my own sword, whilst I see lives the gashes do better upon them?" This quote symbolises the moment when Macbeth becomes a true tragic hero. The castle is being stormed, Macbeth's army is defeated, but Macbeth will not surrender, even when a defeat appears inevitable. At this point, Macbeth regains the sympathy of the audience. For a moment, we forget the abhorred tyrant, and we get a glimpse of the brave Macbeth that we saw at the start of the play. Even though all of the prophecies have abandoned him, Macbeth still chooses to fight till the end. "I will not yield to kiss the ground before young Malcolm's fate." He would rather fight and die at the hands of Macduff than become a coward and die at his own hands. His fatal flaw of ambition, which ultimately caused his downfall, now returns his honour to him. Macbeth comes full circle. He returns to the brave soldier and fearless warrior seen at the beginning of the play. We have seen a true tragic hero in the character of Macbeth.
My name is Enrico Vancini, and I am an Italian exchange student from St. McCartan's College, Monaghan. My favourite quote is Lady Macbeth's, "All the perfumes of Arabia will not sweeten this little hand." This quote expresses the dramatic contrast in Lady Macbeth's character, the sudden sense of guilt that will drive her to death. This contrasts with her previous comments, especially when she is dismissive of Macbeth's guilt. It is ironic that she was indifferent to his suffering and is now suffering the tortures of guilt herself.
My name is Sharon Sperrin. I'm a student at Greenhill Community School in Kilbarrack. My favourite quote is from Act 1, Scene 5. "To beguile the time, look like the time, bear welcome in your eye, your hand, your tongue. Look like the innocent flower, but be the serpent under it." These words fascinate me because they highlight what an ambitious and evil woman Lady Macbeth really is. She is willing to sacrifice her husband's essential goodness to achieve her own ends. We hope against hope that he will not give in to her moral blackmail and demonic force of character.
Malcolm has arrived. No more pretense, no more hiding behind trees. Now they're ready for the battle.
Now near enough, your leafy screens throw down and show like those you are.
Do we but find the tyrant's power tonight? Let us be beaten if we cannot fight.
Make all our trumpets speak, give them all breath, those clamorous harbingers of blood and death.
The battle has begun. Macbeth is fighting his way through impossible odds, but he does it with that certainty that no matter what else may happen, they may take his crown, they may take his country, but they cannot take his life. He has a charmed life.
They have tied me to a stake. I cannot fly, but bear-like I must fight the course. What's he that was not born of woman? Such a one I am to fear, or none.
What is thy name?
Thou'st be afraid to hear it.
No, though thou callest thyself a hotter name than any is in hell.
My name is Macbeth.
And immediately he turns and kills young Siward, without a second thought.
Thou wast born of woman, but swords I smile at, let weapons laugh to scorn, brandished by a man that's of woman born. Why should I play the Roman fool and die on my own sword? While I see lives, the gashes do better upon them.
And that's the warrior speaking. I'm not going to kill myself. I'm not going to end it all. I'll kill anyone who comes near me. He's fighting with tremendous courage, but again, with that certainty that he is invulnerable. But now, he must face his nemesis. Now, he must face his final fear. Now, he's got to meet the doom that the weird sisters and the apparitions foretold. Remember, they always told the truth. It must come to pass. And he finally meets Macduff. That same Macduff, prowling round the battlefield, is trying to find Macbeth.
That way the noise is, tyrant. Show thy face. If thou be'st slain with no stroke of mine, my wife and children's ghosts will haunt me still. I cannot strike at wretched kerns, whose arms are hired to bear their staves. Either thou, Macbeth, or else my sword, with unbattered edge, I sheath undeeded. Let me find him, fortune. And more I beg not.
What he's saying is he doesn't want to fight anybody else. He'll go through the entire battle. He won't fight another soul. There's only one person he wants, and that's Macbeth. Then he finds him.
Turn, hellhound, turn.
Of all men else I have avoided thee. But get thee back. My soul is too much charged with blood of thine already.
I have no words. My voice is in my sword, thou bloodier villain, than terms can give thee out.
Already Macbeth is saying, I don't want to hurt you. I don't want to kill you. I've done enough. The guilt, the pressure of what he's done is building up in him. He just doesn't want any more. But they fight.
Thou losest labor, as easy make the entrenchant air with thy keen sword and press as make me bleed. Let fall the blade on vulnerable crests. I bear a charmed life, which must not yield to one of woman born.
And it's strange, at that moment he is saying to Macduff, you can't kill me, and I don't want to kill you. But he's got to find something out.
Despair thy charm, and let the angel whom thou still hast served tell thee Macduff was from his mother's womb untimely ripped.
And there you have it. There's the simple way that Macbeth was deceived. Macduff was not born from his mother. He was taken out of her womb by a caesarean operation. Ripped from his mother's womb, not born. The fiend told the truth, but Macbeth didn't understand it. And now he knows he's going to die.
Accursed be the tongue that tells me so, for it hath cowed my better part of man, and be these juggling feeds no more believed, that palter with us in a double sense, that keep the word of promise in it to our ear, and break it to our hope. I'll not fight with thee.
Then yield thee, coward, and live to be the show of the gaze of the time. We'll have thee, as our rarer monsters are, painted on a pole and under writ. Hear me, you see the tyrant.
I will not yield, to kiss the ground before young Malcolm's feet, and to be baited with the rabble's curse. Though Burnin' Wood be come to Dunsinane, and thou opposed, being of no woman born, yet I will try the last. Before my body I throw my warlike shield. Lay on, Macduff, and damn be him that first cries, hold, enough.
And that's the final act of courage. He knows he's going to die. He knows that Macduff is the man who will kill him. But right at the end, still, he says, I'm going to die fighting. It's that last act of courage from the warrior and hero that we began the play with, finally breaking through and saying, I'm going to die like a man. I'm not a monster. I am a man, and I'll die like one. Lay on, Macduff, and curse be him that first cries hold enough, is the cry of a hero. And thank you to Sean, to David, to Daryl, to Paul, and to Patrick from Patrician for reading that sequence.
My name is Terry Coffey. I am a teacher at St. Nessence Community College here in Limerick. The question that I want to have a look at today is a question on the theme of deception. It is crucial in any question that you're doing on paper to plan your answer very carefully before you start to write. I would begin by looking at the word deception itself and maybe jot down in your margin a number of different ways of saying deception. For example, equivocation, the difference between what is real and imagined, illusion and apparition. This will avoid repetition of the same word throughout your answer. Next, I would write down all the main ideas that I feel should be discussed in my answer. First of all, Duncan's misplaced trust, the trust that he placed in Cawdor, and the trust that he placed in Macbeth and Lady Macbeth. Things in this play are rarely what they seem. Second of all, I would look at how Lady Macbeth and Macbeth deceive themselves. Third of all, I would look at how the witches deceive Macbeth and ask the question, which is probably the central question in the play, do they actually deceive Macbeth, or does Macbeth deceive himself in over-relying on their prophecies? So those three headings will form the basis or the core of my answer. Next, I would go through each of the main points that I have planned out and make sure that I have some references and quotations from the play to back them up. Our first point will be how Duncan is so easily deceived by the Thane of Cawdor and later by Macbeth and Lady Macbeth. Duncan is guilty of misplaced trust. He says, after the execution of Cawdor, there's no art to find the mind's construction in the face. He was a man on whom I'd built an absolute trust. On entering Macbeth's castle, this castle hath a pleasant seat, the air nimbly and sweetly recommends itself unto our gentle senses. Lady Macbeth says, he that's coming must be provided for. She warns her husband, look like the innocent flower, but be the serpent under it. Macbeth declares that false face must hide what the false heart doth know. Following the murder, in his false outrage, he declares, his silver skin laced with his golden blood. Banquo announces that he fights of treasonous malice. Throughout the opening scene of the play, it is very clear that deception and lack of trust is going to form a major part of it. When we've looked at how Duncan is deceived, it's important to note that, unlike Duncan, his sons Malcolm and Donalbain are very slow to put their trust in anyone. And this is why, he says, there's daggers in men's smiles. That would form the basis of your opening paragraph. In paragraph 2, move on and look at the idea of self-deception and how Lady Macbeth and Macbeth are both guilty of same. Again, I would look through and revise some of the quotes that would help me to back up this answer. When Lady Macbeth says, a little water clears us of this deed, she says, consider it not so deeply. These deeds must not be thought of after these ways, so it will make us mad. And ironically, all of these things come back to haunt her towards the end of the play. She deceives herself into thinking that she can stop up the access and passage to remorse. She wishes that her keen knife see not the wound it makes. Clearly, she is deceiving herself when we see her in the sleepwalking scenes, now haunted by the very blood that she thought she could get rid of. Macbeth, like Lady Macbeth, allows the witches to guide his life. He places all his trust on the same supernatural soliciting as his wife. As a result, he clings to their predictions. He bears a charmed life which must not yield to one of woman born. It is only when the messenger announces that the forest is moving towards Dunsinane does he suspect, finally, the equivocation of a fiend. Macbeth also deceives himself throughout the play. Examples of this would have been the appearance of the dagger, the appearance of the ghost at the banquet scene, the apparitions, and of course the witch's prophecies. He tells himself, thou art a dagger of the mind, a false creation. Banquo, ironically, warns him, after they meet the witches, beware the instrument of darkness. They win us with honest trifles to betray us in the deepest consequence. Foolishly, he thinks he can control them. Now that you've looked at how Macbeth and Lady Macbeth deceive themselves, it is important to ask the question, do the witches deceive Macbeth? Or is it Macbeth's self-deception that brings about his downfall? Is he deceived by the equivocating fiends? Macbeth interprets the witches' prophecies literally. The forest moves to Dunsinane on Malcolm's orders. The armed head on the battlements turns out to be Macbeth's own. The eight kings turn out to be Banquo's dynasty. So one has to ask themselves, was the truth there all the time? Every one of the witches' prophecies did come true. Who was deceiving whom? Did Macbeth deceive himself? Or do you still believe it was the witches' deception? We then move on to our conclusion. The pattern that most essays should form would be, say what you're going to say, say it, and then say what you've said. So in the conclusion, reiterate how deception has played an important role throughout the play. Deception also adds to the dramatic irony of the play. Not just the characters are surprised at the truth of the witches' revelations, so too are the audience, as they see Birnam Wood about to move towards Dunsinane. Macbeth is the most deceived character in the play. He believed his own eyes and ears, he put his faith in the powers of darkness, and this brings about his ultimate downfall.
Macbeth, finally, is dead. The genocide is over, the tyranny is over. His vaunting ambition blinded him to the truth and brought him to his end. And Malcolm is declared king.
Hail, king, for so thou art. Behold where stands the usurper's cursed head. The time is free. I see thee compassed with thy kingdom's pearl, that speak my salutation in their minds, whose voices I desire aloud with mine. Hail, King of Scotland!
Hail, King of Scotland!
Malcolm, who represents the future and the cleansing of the past. Always, a new order will come to sweep away the old. Civilization returns, and the natural order is again in place. Of course, assuming that another despot doesn't come along. And thank you to Sean, Raymond, Daryl, Patrick, Jonathan, David, Michal, and Michael, all from Patrician. Thank you. And in today's quiz, representing St. Louis, we have
Karen Harrigan.
From Patrician, we have
Sean Carlin.
From Collegiate,
Valer Fanny Kirk.
And from St. McCartan's,
Kieran Hendry.
Now, we're going to begin with a question for each of you. Karen, who says, some holy angel fly to the court of England and unfold his message ere he come, that a swift blessing may soon return to this our suffering country, under a hand accursed?
Lennox.
Well done. That's 2 points. Sean, who says, here's the smell of the blood still. All the perfumes of Arabia will not sweeten this little hand.
Lady Macbeth.
Correct. 2 points. Villem, who says, now does he feel his title hang loose about him, like a giant's robe upon a dwarfish thief?
Caithness.
Well done. Tricky one. And Kieran, who says, life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more?
Macbeth.
Macbeth is right. 2 points each. Well done. Round two is our recorded round. I want you each to listen to your particularly recorded piece and tell me who's speaking to who in it. First of all, Karen, this is yours.
Duncan comes here tonight.
And when goes hence?
Tomorrow, as he purposes.
Oh, never shall sun that morrow see.
Now, who is speaking there?
Macbeth, Lady Macbeth.
Well done. 2 points. Sean, here's yours.
I'll to England, to Ireland I. Our separated fortune shall keep us both the safer. Where we are, there's daggers in men's smiles. The near in blood, the nearer bloody. This murderous shaft that shot had not yet lighted, and our safest way is to avoid the aim.
Malcolm is speaking to Donald Bain.
Correct. Villa, here's yours.
How came she by that light?
Why, it stood by her. She has light by her continually. It is her command.
You see, her eyes are open.
Aye, but their sense is shut.
What is it she does now? Look how she rubs her hands.
It is an accustomed action with her to seem thus washing her hands. I have known her continue in this a quarter of an hour.
So, doctor to the gentlewoman.
Well done, Lily, that's correct. 2 points. And finally, Kieran, here's yours.
I see thee compassed with thy kingdom's pearl that speak my salutation in their minds, whose voices I desire aloud with mine. Hail, King of Scotland!
Hail, King of Scotland!
We shall not spend a large expense of time before we reckon with our several loves and make us even with you.
Who's speaking there?
Is it Macduff speaking to Malcolm?
It is indeed. Well done. 2 points. And we're at level pegging here. 4 points for each team. So we go on to the round of quickfire questions. Now, fingers on buzzers. Here we go. Who leads the English army? And that is Sean.
Malcolm, Seward and Macduff.
Well done. That's correct. All three are right. When Macbeth hears that Macduff is fled to England, he goes to Fife. Why?
To kill Macduff's wife and children.
That's correct. Who tells Macduff of his family's... that's Villa?
Ross.
Ross is correct. In Act 5 of the play, Lady Macbeth is suffering from a nocturnal ailment. What is it? That was Sean.
Somnambulism. Sleepwalking.
Sleepwalking. Well done, yes. What is Lady Macbeth trying to do when she imagines she's washing her hands?
She's trying to wash the blood off her hands.
Trying to clean the blood from them. Well done. Where's the English army going? That is Villa.
Burnham Wood.
To Burnham Wood, correct. A lot of strange characters in this one. Angus, Caithness, Monteith, Lennox. Who are they going to support?
Malcolm.
That's Sean.
Malcolm.
Yes, Malcolm, correct. What castle does Macbeth fortify? That's Villa.
Dunsinane.
Dunsinane. How many soldiers are coming? Sean.
10,000.
10,000 is correct. Hew down a bough and bear it before him. Why does Malcolm tell this to his soldiers? Yes, Sean.
So that he may cover the numbers of soldiers, conceal the numbers.
To shadow the number of soldiers, yes, that's well done. When looking towards Burnham, what does the servant say he saw? Sean again.
He saw the forest move.
Yes, correct. Who's the first soldier that Macbeth kills?
Young Seward.
Young Seward, that was Villa, yes, well done. What does Macduff say he will write about Macbeth painted upon a pole? And that's Kira. If you push the buzzer, you've got to know the answer.
It's the pass.
Time out. Here may you see the tyrant.
Yeah.
What does Macduff reveal to Macbeth when they meet in battle? And that's Sean.
That he was not of woman born.
That's right. Do you know what he says?
I was from my mother's womb entirely ripped.
Well done. Yes, well-deserved point. When Macbeth presents himself to Malcolm and Dunsinane after the battle, what does he present him with?
The title of a king.
No, something infinitely less pleasant. Villa.
The head of Macbeth.
The head of Macbeth. Well done. At the end of that particular quiz, the results are as follows. St. McCartan's, 4 points. St. Louis, 5 points. Collegiate, 9 points. And Patrician, 12 points. I think my favourite speech in the play is probably not the dagger speech, but... She should have died hereafter, tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. It's a speech of a man who's just reached the end of his tether, that he's got to the point when I am too tired. Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps in this petty pace from day to day to the last syllable of recorded time, and all our yesterdays of lighted fools await. Out, out, brief candle. Life's but a walking shadow, poor play. It's just a speech of tiredness. I've done all this, and what do I end up? Tired. I have a load of favourite scenes in this play. It's actually riddled with them. I think the moment when Macbeth returns after the murder is absolute classic Shakespeare. That he walks in, he's carrying these daggers, his hands are covered in blood, and he and the lady share lines between them that are all to do with fear and tension. He comes in and says these five words, "I have done the deed." He can't even bring himself to say, "I've done the murder." It's as though they're pretending it didn't happen for a moment. And then he sees his own hands and is horrified at what he sees. It's a beautifully written scene, and it's between a man and a woman who love one another and have done something unspeakably dreadful for each other. My favourite character in the play has to be Macbeth. He's so human. He's so much of a man put into a position where all his ambition and greed and desires and wishes can come true. Anybody who is put into a position where by some magic or other you're told whatever you want you can do, or nobody can kill you. You've got carte blanche to do anything, and we all think, oh God, that'd be wonderful, we can do so many good things, and you end up becoming corrupt. He is an everyman character who is promised invulnerability and doesn't realise that there is a cost to pay. He's very, very human. Our production crew today was Kevin Reynolds, Catherine Brennan, Sean Rocks, and Orla Cotter, with Tony Lyons on sound. Thank you to the students and teachers of St. Louis Secondary School, Carrickmacross, Monaghan Collegiate College, the Patrician High School in Carrickmacross, and St. McCartan's College in Monaghan. And I'm Alan Stamford of Second Age Data Company.
You've been listening to a podcast from RTE Radio 1. For more details of our podcasts, visit rte.ie/radio1.